And it is really going to be a course not so much about the phenomenology beyond the standard model, but rather of ideas connected with it and that have emerged from it that are still, after 20, 30, some cases even 40 years later, still important. And they will be anomalies, which we'll spend a fair amount of time on, instantons, and monopoles. You probably know my name already, but just in case you don't, it's Robert Mann. And I come to this place from time to time. I'm an affiliate of the Institute, but I'm regularly employed by the University of Waterloo, where I have been for quite some time. And I, while I'm doing this course, I have an office that's just down the hall on the second floor, but I don't remember the room number. Tibra, I don't know, is that relevant, or they'll just find it by sense of smell? I did take a shower this morning. It's not that bad. Okay. So what I want to do today, I understand yesterday you had a bit of a tutorial on some of this material, and today is really, I think, just going to be primarily introductory and orienting to some of the concepts that we'll be looking at, some of the arithmetic or mathematical technology that's needed for this subject. You've all had a course, I guess, on basic gauge theory and QFT, as I understand it, right? So some of this is really review and partly to establish with you the kind of the way I like to write down the notation. But let's I just thought I'd make some introductory remarks about why gauge theories. These things came into their own really in the 1970s, though the ideas have been around, you could argue, since the 1850s, where Maxwell constructed what we would now call the first and simplest gauge theory, namely the theory of electromagnetism. It was discovered in the 40s. A proposal was given for how to treat electromagnetism as a quantum theory, as a quantum field theory, and it contained puzzling features, particularly that the idea of subtracting infinities so that quantities that were physical could be extracted from the theory in a predictive way. And this, of course, was at the time greatly disturbing, and in my opinion still should be to some extent. But it was successfully proved in the 1950s that an abelian gauge theory can be consistently renormalized to all orders in perturbation theory. And in the 70s, the analog of that was proven for non-abelian gauge theories. So the reason for gauge theories after that point is it was found they're the most useful structure for describing all non-gravitational interactions. And that remains true today, I would contend, despite many efforts in alternative directions, which of course we should continue to look at. Gauge theories have remained with us, and any future theory of physics is going to have to reduce to these kinds of things in certainly in a low energy, weak gravitational limit. And so, as I'm sure you all know, the standard model is usually given, by writing it as SU3 color cross SU2 cross U1, and this is often put in as an L, and this is the electroweak sector of the standard model. So this U1 is not the U1 of electromagnetism, rather a combination of a diagonal element here and the generator there mixed together to give the photon, which is the photon we know, and a U1 symmetry associated with that, and the alternative combination, the orthogonal combination, is what we end up calling the Z boson. So this symmetry is on the scale of about 100 GeV, is broken to SU3 color cross U1, and this is the strong interaction that we know, and this is electricity and magnetism. So gravity is a bit different, and there has been a debate going on in the community since it was realized in the 1970s that gauge theories were renormalizable as to whether or not gravity is or is not a gauge theory. In a weak field limit, it looks that way, but it really doesn't look that way from a curved space-time viewpoint. And a lot of the discussion about how to treat gravity depends on whether or not it really should be considered as a gauge theory. To the extent it is one, it does behave differently than these. I'm not going to say much more about gravity in this course. I just wanted this to be acknowledged. So I've never played with these buttons before, so what do I do? If I want this to go up, what do I do?
Probably want to go to manual, then you can control each individually. So,
no, that's not what I want to do. I want to do, that's what I want to do. And then let's put this down here. So, so just to review, how do you build a gauge theory? So there are some basic principles used in this. One has to do with imposing certain assumptions about invariance, namely the laws of physics are invariant. I don't mean the equations of motion, I really mean the action here, of course. The laws of physics are invariant under SO3, one cross the translations. This is what we call the Poincaré group. So in other words, physics doesn't care about where your origin is. It doesn't care about how you orient your coordinates. It doesn't care whether you're standing still or moving relative to some point at constant velocity. And that's a basic assumption which we can actually, under certain circumstances, test in various ways, whether or not there is, in fact, position dependence of clocks, how clocks tick, whether or not there is velocity dependence of clocks, and these kinds of things are tested, and we have very good reason to believe that this is correct. And gauge theories are built on this idea. Of course, it's now become fashionable to pretend, well, maybe at very high energies, this is not quite correct, and that the Poincaré group does get modified. Things like doubly special relativity would fall into that category. But I'm talking about how people build gauge theories. So the other idea is that fundamental or elementary particles fundamental, or what we would call elementary particles, correspond to irreducible representations of the Poincaré group. And this was Wigner's idea in 1939. How many are familiar with these two premises here? Okay, most of you, I guess, right? All right, so I don't need to go too much into that. The idea is that you use this to build relativistic wave equations. And then, or actions, and then from that, you you then proceed. The idea came about, how do we know what an elementary particle actually is? How do we describe it? And Wigner's idea was, well, its wave function, which ultimately became its quantum field, must be an irreducible representation that reflects this basic principle here. That was the philosophy. And that appears to be true. So just as we all, as I guess you've seen probably in some context, for a spin zero particle, we'd say the field was phi of x. We would say the action for this thing would be the integral of d4x times a half d mu phi minus m squared phi squared. And the equation of motion would be d squared plus m squared phi is equal to zero, and this is the Klein-Gordon equation. And then in the Dirac case, I might as well write them all out, the field is called psi of x, typically, and then the action is given by the integral of psi bar I d slash minus m psi, and the equation of motion is I d slash, minus m psi is zero, where of course slash, A slash is defined as gamma mu A mu for any four vector operator. Okay, you've all seen, yeah.
So, quick question. In what sense is the converse of two expected to be true? Like, in what sense do we expect the irreducible representations to correspond to particles?
The answer is either not much or in totality, in part depending on who you talk to these days. So nature stops at spin two. To the best of our knowledge, we have no empirical evidence at this point in history of any particles that have any elementary particles of spin greater than two. The graviton is spin two. There is no evidence of a particle of spin three halves. If you believe supergravity is right, then there is such a thing. It's called the gravitino. The only way, for a long time, people wondered what to do about spins that were bigger than two, and there is a spin five halves action and equation you can write down. It's called the Fiertz-Pauli action and the Fiertz-Pauli equation, but no one knows how to self-consistently couple it to any other field, except unless you include fields of every possible spin. And this is now under active consideration in recent years, higher spin gauge fields, higher spin gauge theories, where every possible spin is believed to be included in the mix. And this is logically admissible, and people are exploring it. But for this is within the last couple of years. Prior to that, people basically just didn't do it because there wasn't good empirical motivation. It's either an act of creativity or desperation, depending on your perspective. But this is how people are looking at it. Is that getting at your question? But the notion, you may have had this spelled out for you, but just in case you have a friend that hasn't, the reason for an irreducible representation is that all components of the wave function change into each other under the symmetry. Whereas if you had a reducible representation, that would be like considering two distinct particles, because under the symmetry, one part of the representation would change into itself, the other part would change into itself, but the two never mix together. So why consider them together? You should break them into the irreducible pieces. That's the philosophy. Sometimes that's obvious to people, sometimes it's not at all obvious, but it's better you hear it here than pick it up off the streets. Okay, so, and then E&M, or an abelian gauge theory, would spin one, would be A mu, and the action is d4x times minus a quarter times the square of the Faraday tensor, and the equation is d mu, f mu nu is zero, where f mu nu, by definition, is the curl of that field. And those are Maxwell's equations. And as you saw, I expect, in quantum field theory, at the moment, these are all classical actions. One, in order to describe them quantum mechanically, the first thing people tried, actually, was to consider phi as a wave function. But they discovered that there were negative energy states that one could not get rid of. So, for example, if you tried a problem where you took a phi particle and scattered it off a potential barrier, you could reflect a state of negative energy. And no one knew how to get rid of these. That was part of the motivation for Dirac suggesting to go from a second order to a first order differential equation. But those equations were also found to have negative energy solutions. And then Dirac thought, well, let's fill all those negative energy states because these are spin a half particles and we'll apply the Pauli principle. And that led ultimately to the notion of antiparticles and the idea that these are not wave functions, these are actually quantum fields that create and destroy particles when acting on various quantum states in the theory, yeah.
So also for the Klein-Gordon equation, the analog of the probability density is not probability.
Yes, that's right. There were difficulties in interpreting probability densities and these kinds of things, but the first thing people tried to do in the late 1920s was make sense of them that way. And then around 1930, actually, it was discovered that when you took the combination of this with that, when you included a coupling, people discovered that the leading order quantum corrections were divergent or infinite. And this problem remained for 15 or 16 years until Feynman Schwinger and Tominaga proposed in the mid-1940s that the way to solve this is to absorb the infinities into the various definitions of mass and charge. Okay, so I guess I'll go over here. Should I do one more? Let's see. If I put that in the middle. Sorry? Oh, this is so much fun. Okay, so, oops, now what did I do? It's dangerous if you don't watch what buttons you're pushing. Okay, so the Dirac equation. The Dirac equation is ID slash minus M psi is zero. And we believe this equation describes every elementary fermion that we know of in the absence of other interactions. When interactions with other things could be neglected, every quark, every lepton obeys this equation. And we have no empirical evidence to the contrary at this point in time. Of course, when it comes to quarks, we can never really infer they're not having any interactions. So this is an extrapolation. But nevertheless, we think that's the case. And it's known this equation has a phase symmetry. I'm sure you've seen this principle before, that if I take psi prime as e to the I alpha psi, then the primed field also obeys the same equation. And this is no different than non-relativistic Schrodinger theory. And this is the only symmetry of this equation. When the mass of the field is not zero. But something different happens when the mass of the field is zero. So the set of phases is called the group U1, the group of unitary 1-by-1 matrices. And it's a global symmetry if alpha is constant, which means the phase has to be changed the same everywhere at all places and times. But as is known, if alpha is some function of space-time location, then, of course, if psi prime is equal to e to the I alpha x of psi, then you all know that ID slash, or at least I'm pretty sure you've seen this, that this is not the case because the derivative operator acts on alpha of x, and therefore the equation is not the same. In fact, what happens to this equation is it becomes ID slash minus m psi times e to the I alpha, and then minus an e to the I alpha d slash alpha times psi. And that's certainly not zero. If this obeys Dirac, then the prime does not. If the prime obeys Dirac, then the psi will not. You can't have it both ways. Unless, of course, you introduce a gauge field. So if we introduce A mu such that A changes whenever psi changes, and then we define d mu to be the partial plus IE A mu, then D mu of psi, actually I'm going to call this capital psi. Suppose we have some field capital psi transforming like so. Then the whole point of introducing this derivative is that d mu of capital psi all primed turns out to be e to the I alpha of x d mu of capital psi, regardless of whether psi is a scalar or a spinner. If it obeys, whether it's relativistic, whether it's not relativistic, any object changing under a local phase will obey this simply because if I work this out, I've got d mu of the prime plus IE a mu prime, which is d mu of e to the I alpha of the big psi plus IE a mu minus 1 over E d mu of alpha. And then this is times e to the I alpha big psi. So e to the I alpha factors out. and I get d mu of big psi plus I d mu of alpha psi plus I e a mu of psi, and then minus I d mu alpha of psi, and that cancels that, and we're left with e to the I alpha times the covariant derivative. So that's why it's called a covariant derivative. It varies along with the local phase transformation. So in the case of the Dirac field, the Dirac equation becomes d I capital D slash minus m psi is zero. So this tells us how a psi field is affected by that A vector field or vector potential, as it's sometimes called. And A has to be a spin one field because it's a four vector and must transform that way. So the simplest relation we can construct is Maxwell's equations. So the Maxwell equation for this theory will be d mu f mu nu. And the only issue here, of course, is that if psi interacts with A via this relation, there has to be some way of A interacting with psi, if you like, in what one might call a back reaction. And the answer is that is the case. And one has this pair of equations that I call the Maxwell-Dirac equations, or what some people like to say are the foundation for quantum electrodynamics. And the action for the theory then is the integral of d4x. And instead of that thing up there with the little d, we have psi bar capital D slash minus m psi, and then minus a quarter f mu nu f mu nu. So that is one way of understanding, I guess, the modern or current way of understanding where quantum electromagnetism comes from. It comes from demanding that this local phase symmetry hold for all fermions, and it seems to work. All electromagnetic interactions are governed by this pair of equations, along with their quantum corrections when these are understood as quantum fields. And this is the most accurate, this theory has the most precise agreement between theory and experiment of any non-gravitational theory we know of anywhere. Gravity seems to rival this theory, and there was, for a short period of time, an argument between the two groups who then realized it was a silly argument, so I think they stopped, as to whether gravity was more precise, because the binary pulsar PSR 1913 plus 16 also has equivalent level of agreement between theory and experiment in terms of decimal place precision. And then the particle guys would say, oh, but you're including Newton's effects. And so they go right back, well, you're including Maxwell's effects. What? To me, it's a stupid argument, but it did happen. At least I was there when I heard people arguing about it at conferences. So is this okay so far? How many are familiar with this kind of thing? Most, if not all. Okay. So no one knows how to solve these equations exactly. But what is done is to solve these perturbatively in powers of the coupling under the formalism of quantum field theory, where these are regarded as quantum fields that have creation and annihilation operators associated with them. And the coupling, actually, the perturbative coupling is E squared over H bar C. Actually, sometimes there's a 4 pi. And that's basically 1 over 137 point 0 or 0.0 something or other. So a couple of other remarks. This is the simplest gauge theory in the sense it is also minimally coupled. But it's not uniquely determined by this action. For example, a less simple theory would have, or could have, for example, the action be, well, maybe you guys, I'll have to raise that. Is that a bit better so you can see? A less simple theory you could write down that obeys all of these principles of Poincaré invariance and local phase invariance would be psi bar I d slash plus gamma mu gamma nu or capital D slash I d slash plus gamma mu gamma nu F mu nu, and what else could we have? Minus M acting on psi minus a quarter F mu nu. That's also gauge invariant, but it's not minimally coupled in the sense that there are more derivatives and fields in this term than there are in that first term. This has the fewest number of derivatives and fields. This has more. In fact, this kind of term is induced by quantum corrections, and this leads to what is called the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron. I guess I should put some coefficient in here. But on general grounds, this, of course, could be included. If you do include it, you destroy the renormalizability of the theory, so that's a good reason for not including it. But you need more information to get rid of this kind of term at the outset, because phase invariance and Poincaré invariance are not enough. So as we all know or have heard of, QED is renormalizable, which means it is, I've said several times, it's renormalizable, which means that everything is everything can be predicted from the theory that has to do with electromagnetism. This is remark number, I guess I didn't list them, that's another bullet point, I suppose. So all electromagnetic phenomena, I would say, are in principle describable by this theory. Given the mass and the charge of the, maybe I should say charges, I could put a subscript, given the masses and charges of the various particles that are in the theory, once they are known, then the renormalizability machine allows you to predict everything else based on that. And another another important point is the U1 invariance is preserved to all orders in alpha, in the coupling. And in part, this is intimately connected with the fact that d mu j mu is zero, where j mu is equal to E psi bar gamma mu psi, that one can show at the quantum level that renormalizability crucially depends on the conservation of this current as quantum corrected to all powers in the coupling alpha. And if you broke that gauge invariance, then you would lose this property. This is one of the reasons why people believe gauge invariance matters, because it preserves the predictive power of the theory. And if you lose renormalizability, you lose that. Is this okay so far? Okay, so where are we? So then the idea came along in the 1950s by Yang and Mills of generalizing this symmetry. And suppose you have a field psi prime, and it is related to let's just be very explicit, and it's related by kind of a phase symmetry, but a more general one in which we have a set of fields labeled by this capital index. That's not a spinner index, it's a multiplet index. And the idea is the phase symmetry can mix up all the components of this into a new set of multiplet components. And that is that was the idea, where alpha dot t means alpha a ta. Maybe I'll write it like that. And these t's are matrices that obey this rule. And I think I'm missing a factor of I in here, where the t's obey this rule, which means they are elements of a Lie algebra. And so these t's, this is the exponential of a matrix. So e to the I alpha t is a group, is a Lie group element. And the short story of Lie groups or Lie group elements is a guy named Sophus Lie in the 1870s wondered what a group would look like or behave like, what its mathematical properties would be, if the group elements were functions of a finite number of parameters. In this case, those parameters would be alpha. Basically, every Lie group element can always be written as this kind of exponential, at least locally. And one can show that, for example, closure of the group implies this identity. If you demand that the product of two things that look like this is another thing that looks like this, when you Taylor expand in powers of the parameter alpha, then you find the t's must obey this relationship, whereas I'm sure you know these are called the structure constants of the group. So they characterize the group. If you know the c's, you know the group. If you know the group, you know the c's, up to certain topological properties of the group. But you at least, if you know the c's, you know all the behavior of the group for elements that are continuously connected to the identities. So what, to the identity, sorry. Oops, wrong one. So, so d mu now becomes something a little more general. It becomes I, g, a mu, but now we have to contract a mu into t. In other words, instead of just one vector potential, we have a set of vector potentials, and there are as many of them as there are generators of the group. So we have a finite number of t's. This can reduce to the previous one in the sense the generator for U1 is a trivial generator. It's basically, I guess, just equal to the identity effectively. So this just becomes one field. But if we have a complicated, more complicated group structure, then the covariant derivative becomes that. And so we have d mu. So if psi prime is equal to A is equal to e to the I alpha dot t AB psi B, then we find that d mu of psi prime is equal to e to the I alpha dot t acting on d mu of psi, where if I put in the indices here, then that's an A, that's an AB, and that's a B, if one likes to see explicit indices. So I don't think I need to go through that exercise again, except I guess I should say that I should put down the transformation for the A field, which I realize I didn't leave quite enough room for. Maybe I'll put it up here. That's a bit sloppy on the blackboard. But provided that, of course, A prime A, that this thing is equal to e to the I alpha t A mu and then plus I over G times e to the minus I alpha t d mu e to the I alpha t, I think. So G is the coupling constant of the group, and the gauge field transforms in a manner that the first term would be trivial if the group is abelian, everything commutes with everything else, and the exponentials cancel. And then the last term just reduces to the derivative of the parameter alpha, and you recover the previous expression. I'm guessing you guys have all seen this before as well, right? Okay. So we're going to get to something at least a little bit different, I hope, in a few minutes. The field strength is given by the commutator of two covariant derivatives. And that works out to be equal to d mu a nu a plus, or minus, sorry, d nu a mu a plus, or minus, I guess, this structure constant CABC times AB mu AC nu. And you can absorb G into the definition of the fields or the structure constants as you like. I guess here, if I put it in properly, I guess there should be an IG there, I think. So the action for these things is going to be just the integral of d4x times a quarter times psi bar I d slash minus m psi minus a quarter times the sum over A of FA mu nu FA mu nu, which we often like to write as the trace. This is often written as the trace of F squared, where the trace means sum over these Latin indices A, which run over the number of generators of the group. So then we have this result that if TA belongs to U1, we have electromagnetism. If TA belongs to SU3, we say that's QCD. And then if TA belongs to SU2 cross U1, then we have electroweak. control weak. Or quantum flavor dynamics. Yeah, sorry. Yes, they're meant to be elements of the Lie algebras of these groups. Yes, that's right. Yes. Sometimes it's common, and sometimes I might get sloppy, to interchange the notion of algebra with group. They're not exactly the same. Lie algebra is basically the Taylor series expansion of a Lie group. But if you're not worried about topological aspects, people tend to use them interchangeably. The best known example, unfortunately the most common and therefore the most confusing, is SU2 and SO3, which are two different groups that have exactly the same Lie algebra. If you Taylor series expand both groups, you get the same kind of expansion, but the topological properties of SU2 are different than of SO3 when you look at them as group manifolds. And so, probably used up everything I can use here. So, that tends to get confusing because both of those groups play a very important role in physics. But we have to live with them. So, let me try and get in the remaining time here to material that's a preview of some of the things that we'll do in the course. And what I did up till now is I hope to establish some common ground. So we have this Lagrangian, say, S is the integral of d4xL. And what I just wrote on the other board implies that L is psi bar I d slash minus m psi minus a quarter times, let's just go back to QED for a minute, f mu nu for QED, say, or for U1 gauge theory, we have that. Now, if m is 0, then we get a lot more symmetry. I call it theta, I guess. So if you had no mass for this psi field, if this mass term went to 0, then you find that globally, this is the case where gamma 5 is I gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3. It's the product of all four gamma matrices times I. Sometimes it's written as, I think with a factorial, epsilon mu nu alpha beta, gamma mu, gamma nu, gamma alpha, gamma beta. I think we need I over 4 factorial here to get agreement. So this is a new gauge invariance or a new symmetry. It's called chiral invariance. And it plays a very important role in standard model physics, and it's thought in beyond the standard model physics. So if we wanted to make it local, so what if this parameter theta now is a function of x? What if we wanted to make this thing a local invariance? Well, we can repeat this procedure that I sketched out earlier, and that I think I may have just rubbed off on this board. We can repeat this procedure I sketched out earlier. You introduce a field B mu that transforms just like the A mu field transforms. And whenever you did this, you would do this simultaneously. And if you repeated that same procedure, you would get an action that would have two different kinds of gauge fields, and therefore two different kinds of field strengths. And it would be this. You would have L. So you can go through exactly the same procedure, and you would have L would equal psi bar times I d slash plus I e a slash plus I g b slash gamma 5 psi minus 1/4 f mu nu of a. This will depend on A, and then you'll have the same F mu nu type term for B, F mu nu B, F mu nu B, where F is defined as the curl of whatever the relevant gauge field is. And this would be said to be U1V cross U1A invariant. In other words, it's invariant under this vectorial gauge symmetry, and it's invariant under this axial vectorial gauge symmetry. This can be a bit awkward, and it's actually common to rewrite these things like so. We write them in terms of what are called right and left-handed fields, where psi left is equal to 1/2 1 minus gamma 5 psi, and psi right is 1/2 1 plus gamma 5 psi. If we add these together, then we get the top equation, and if you take the bars of those equations and conjugate properly, you'll get the bottom pair of equations. And we can also write 1 over root 2 EA minus GB is equal to EV. Let's put mu and mu and mu. And I can write 1 over root 2 EA mu plus GB mu is equal to let's call it GW, though they're not really, maybe I should put tildes there, I suppose. And so if one does that, then you find that the Lagrangian becomes psi bar left, I d slash plus I e v slash psi left, and then you get psi bar right times I d slash plus I g w slash psi right, and then minus 1/4 f squared of v and minus 1/4 f squared of w, where I'm getting tired of writing those indices, so I just mean f squareds. And f squared is short for f mu nu, f mu nu. So in other words, the Lagrangian breaks up into two completely distinct pieces on psi right and psi left. It's as though psi left obeys its own gauge theory with the vector field v, and psi right obeys its own gauge theory with the vector field w, yeah.
Are different?
Yeah, they're different. I should put tildes on them. So this will be a tilde and this will be a tilde. Yeah. And so if you look at the phase invariants, psi left If you look at the phase invariant, psi left prime is e to the I alpha minus theta psi left, and psi right prime is transforms as e to the I alpha plus theta psi right, and v mu prime is equal to v mu minus 1 over e tilde d mu alpha minus theta, and w mu prime is w mu minus 1 over g tilde d mu of alpha plus theta. So the point is that these things break up into two distinct worlds, neither of which knows about the other. And if you believed that nature maximizes symmetry, then you would use this. But the problem is, these things are broken by quantum effects. So the problem is that the relevant currents are no longer conserved once quantum effects are included. So classically, by which I mean non-quantum mechanically, classically, d mu of psi bar gamma mu psi for the left thing is zero, and d mu of psi bar gamma mu psi for the right-hand field is zero. But in quantum mechanics or quantum field theory, they are not. Quantum effects imply that this thing is not zero. It's actually equal to, in the language I've used with the tildes, e tilde squared over 32 pi squared times epsilon mu nu alpha beta f mu nu f alpha beta, or the dot product of the electric and magnetic fields in the system. And there's likewise, this would be for the vector field v, of course, and there is an analogous thing for w. I guess I might as well write it for the sake of completeness. So it's FF dual, or FF times the epsilon tensor, generates something that no longer gives conservation to this current. Yes?
How do you go about calculating those numbers?
Well, that's going to be the part of the subject of this course. That's why this is a preview. We'll get to that in another class. So I'm showing you what the answer is, and then later on, obviously not today, I'll show you how you get it. This is called the chiral abelian anomaly. There is a non-abelian anomaly, which I don't think I can explain in a minute, but it's an anomaly in the sense the current should be conserved, but it is not conserved. So a decent chunk of this course is going to be understanding how does this come about, like how do you calculate it, why it's there, what its implications are for physics, the standard model, and to some extent beyond the standard model. This is a very important feature. In particular, electroweak interactions have a Lagrangian of this type. The left-handed fields couple to the W's and Z's, but the right-handed fields do not. So the electroweak Lagrangian actually is a Lagrangian of this type. And therefore, it will have this structure. What happens is that this structure actually ends up getting canceled this structure ends up getting canceled out due to the particular properties of the fermions that exist in our world. In other words, the representations that are permitted mathematically to give a consistent renormalizable theory are not any old representations you want. They have to be representations such that this kind of term disappears. And how that's going to come about is going to be the subject of what comes up in this course in part. So this has a lot of implications for standard model physics. And I will, in future classes, show you how you calculate this, what it means for physics, what the implications are beyond the standard model. How many have seen the anomaly before? One. Well, that's good. Now you're going to begin to learn something. So any other questions for today? We got to stop now, right, Tibra? I think, yeah. Any other questions for today? There's a non-abelian version. We'll pick up from there next time, and we'll go into the details about all of these things for the next number of classes. Yep.
So the way you derive this, you started with the massless fermion and then decompose it to the left and right.
That's right.
You could have started the opposite way where you were free to introduce a left-handed fermion but not say the right-handed.
That's right. If you decided to start only with left and right, that's fine. And the way we like, the way people in particle physics like to regard mass is really a derivative effect or a residual effect from symmetry breaking. It's not regarded really as a fundamental parameter of the theory, and we now have empirical reason to believe that because we've discovered a Higgs particle, or what I think is a Higgs, though there are still some people saying maybe it's not really a Higgs. Sure as heck, you know, looks like a Higgs, it quacks like a Higgs, smells like a Higgs. But anyway, we do believe, or we now have good empirical reason to believe, that masses are not fundamental parameters in a Lagrangian. Rather, they are parameters derived from couplings of fermions to other field, and left and right can couple independently to this field, at least in principle. And so it is believed that unified theories of nature, if there are such things, at ultra-high energies do not have mass parameters. So you have left and right-handed fields, and therefore you have this larger degree of symmetry to start with, and this can be exploited to do a number of things. String theory, in some sense, is predicated on exploiting this idea in a different way, that left and right couple independently, or can couple independently to the other fields of nature. But there is a constraint. You can't couple any way you like, because if you do, you'll get this. If you get this, you'll destroy renormalizability. This is fatal to a theory if it exists. So right now, this theory has this, and this theory could not be renormalized. So what I have to do is doctor the theory or tinker with it to get rid of this thing, and that's part of the discussion. And there's a non-abelian version of it as well. And these things have topological significance. They have physical significance. Lots of things happen. All right, I guess we're done. So I see it. So tomorrow we're at 9, right?
Right.
And Friday we're at 9. And then next week we go to this, yeah, alternating.
On Monday and